Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. I'm here with engineer Mike Murphy and Anna Banana, who will be joining us later in the show. The forecast today is cloudy and rainy and foggy all day long and into the evening. Showers and thunderstorms are expected to continue tonight and pretty much on and off for the rest of the week. So it should stay relatively warm in the 70s during the day. So I've heard rumors that this is going to be a very, very wet spring, despite the almost drought conditions we've been experiencing so far. So we'll see what happens. Okay, let's go to Mr. Dennis Hart with the news. Dennis?
The ongoing coronavirus pandemic, rising gasoline prices, and new worries about the drought all made big news around the state last week. First, the coronavirus. The death toll statewide from the virus since the pandemic started went up, reaching 6,000 this past weekend. And the number of people infected by the virus also climbed, approaching the 400,000 mark by yesterday. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said last week, in her words, "There's no reason for us to continue to fear COVID-19 any longer." She said, again in her words, "We know how to manage it and that individuals can be trusted to make decisions that will keep us on a path forward." This, as the Centers for Disease Control announced that Americans who are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus do not have to wear a mask in most situations, indoors or outdoors. That marked a major turning point in the pandemic, and it came after the Federal Food and Drug Administration said that the Pfizer vaccine is safe and effective enough to give to younger teens. That decision means adolescents from 12 to 15 now qualify for the shots. And this past Thursday, Iowa pharmacies and clinics started vaccinating kids as young as 12. And in the wake of the CDC's announcement, Iowa cities, sports teams, and other institutions started changing or ending mask requirements. This past Friday, Des Moines Mayor Frank County rescinded that city's mask mandate, effective immediately. Cedar Rapids did not end its mask mandate, but altered it to exempt those who are fully vaccinated. The state Supreme Court issued new guidance that people who are fully vaccinated will no longer need to wear masks in court facilities. And the head of the Iowa Department of Public Health wrote a letter to school superintendents around the state advising them to drop mask mandates as the pandemic wanes. All this as word came that the state of Iowa would receive nearly $1.5 billion under the federal government's plan to help states hit by the coronavirus pandemic. That plan will distribute $350 billion overall to state, local, territorial, and tribal governments. The Treasury Department says governments can use the money to cover local public health costs, to address the economic impacts of the pandemic, and to replace lost tax revenue. Earlier last week, the governor announced that the state of Iowa is cutting federal jobless insurance benefits that were created at the start of the pandemic last year. The governor said those benefits are holding back the state's economy because they are discouraging people from returning to work. She said the state has more jobs available than unemployed people. She said the federal benefits will expire June 12th. Also last week, word that state officials had started sending grocery vouchers to tens of thousands of Iowa families with children who had been out of school, at least in part, to the coronavirus pandemic. The program, financed with federal money, aims to make up for free or reduced-price meals that children missed because they had stayed at home, either full-time or in hybrid learning programs, during this past school year. And there was more at the state capitol last week. The governor signed a bill that does away with the statute of limitations to bring criminal charges for several sexual abuse-related crimes committed against minors. The new law will get rid of the statute of limitations for crimes against children under 18, including sexual abuse, incest, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking. The law had had bipartisan support in the legislature, passing unanimously in the state Senate, and by an 84-2 vote in the state House. Also last week, the governor signed a bill that ends the voluntary diversity plans that school districts in Davenport, Des Moines, Waterloo, West Liberty, and Postville have used for years to regulate open enrollment in their districts. Republicans had pushed for the change as part of a package of school choice efforts this year. The governor had said she supported the bill because it expands opportunities for parents to decide where to send their children. She also signed a bill that allows third-party companies to deliver wine, beer, and liquor in Iowa, another bill letting parents teach driver's education to their children, and a bill letting Iowans bring a civil case against someone who makes a harmful, false report against them. Laura Bellin and I will be here tonight at 7 on KHOI Radio's Capital Week to discuss what went on under the Gold Dome in Des Moines last week and what it means for all of us. In other news last week, the Des Moines Water Works put out a warning that the state's drought may soon endanger central Iowa's drinking water supply. The metro area's primary water supply is the Raccoon River, which typically has a water flow of nearly 2 million gallons a minute. The river was said to be down to about 135,000 gallons a minute, and the Water Works facility asked customers to start cutting water use immediately. At the gas pump last week, prices topped $3 a gallon in parts of the Des Moines metro after a cyber attack on the nation's biggest refined products pipeline, the one going from Texas to New Jersey. The average price nationally for gasoline also went above $3 a gallon last week. The last time that took place was in 2014. On the court beat last week, word that the public will be able to watch the trial of the man accused of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts, but not in person. The judge said that because of coronavirus protocols, members of the public and news media would not be allowed inside the courtroom this week when the trial of Christian Bahena Rivera starts in Davenport today. Bahena Rivera is accused of killing Tibbetts 3 years ago while she was out for a run in her hometown of Brooklyn, Iowa. The judge said news outlets can operate remote control video cameras to broadcast the proceedings live on the Internet or on TV. Meanwhile, the Iowa Supreme Court upheld a new state law that limits the ability of criminal defendants to appeal their convictions. That law limits a defendant's ability to appeal a conviction after a guilty plea and requires all claims of ineffective assistance of counsel to be decided during post-conviction relief proceedings rather than later on appeal. There was also word that the state of Iowa would pay a settlement in connection with a carbon monoxide leak at the state's law enforcement academy in Johnston that had sent more than 70 cadets to the hospital. The building's boiler system leaked in November 2018, causing carbon monoxide to seep into the basement. The state has agreed to pay about $31,000 to EMC Insurance and the Iowa Municipality Workers' Compensation Association to cover claims for 21 cadets who were sleeping at the academy at the time. There was also word last week that the commandant of the state veterans home had been relieved of his duties. Commandant Timon O'Jury was replaced by Penny Cutler Bermudez. The Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown is one of the nation's largest state-owned nursing homes for veterans, with around 500 residents and 900 employees. Commandants there serve at the pleasure of the governor. Meanwhile, last week, a national animal rights group said that Iowa has the third most puppy mill businesses in the country. And the Humane Society of the United States said puppies and dogs in some of those mills live in what the society called filthy, hazardous conditions, without adequate care. Iowa had 11 such businesses in the most recent report. Missouri had the most with 21, followed by Ohio with 16, and then Iowa. Rounding out the top five, Nebraska and Pennsylvania each had 8 breeders on the list. In another animal-related story last week, word that the Animal Rescue League of Iowa had found a puppy whose collar was embedded in her neck. Rescue League officials found the puppy, named Junie, in Des Moines. They said the collar was deeply embedded in her neck, nearly killing her. They also said the person responsible for Junie had never adjusted her collar as she grew, leaving it to dig deeper and deeper into her neck like a vise. An emergency care team cut Junie's collar off and said she likely would need surgery. Late last week, a Des Moines man was arrested in connection with the incident. In Pleasant Hill last week, the city council approved plans for a nearly $23 million multipurpose facility on the Southeast Polk High School campus. That will include a football and soccer stadium that will seat more than 6,000 people and include a new track. The money will come from the $92 million bond issue that voters approved last September to fund various school projects. Meanwhile, the Des Moines School Board voted not to extend Superintendent Tom Ahart's current contract past its 2023 expiration date. And last week, word that the Casey's General Stores chain had completed its purchase of Bucky's Convenience Stores, which are mostly located in Nebraska and Illinois. The purchase gives Casey's more than 2,300 stores across the nation. And one more note before I go. This one word from the Des Moines Airport last week that, starting in July, travelers leaving the airport would be able to choose from about 24 nonstop flights to destinations across the nation, the most the airport has ever had. Airlines plan to ramp up their offerings, which were reduced during the coronavirus pandemic. The list of cities is too long to read here, unless you really want me to. Okay, I hear you. Here we go. Here are the cities you'll soon be able to fly nonstop to in alphabetical order. Atlanta, Austin, Charlotte, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Fort Walton Beach, Florida, Detroit, Houston, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Miami, Minneapolis, Nashville, Orlando, Phoenix, Portland, Oregon, Punta Gorda, Florida, Salt Lake City, San Diego, St. Louis, St. Petersburg, Florida, and Washington, D.C. Now, please don't ask me to repeat all that, because I'm out of time. And that is your summary of the week's news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, taking my nonstop flight out of this virtual seat on Local Talk, but planning to make a return visit tonight, when Laura Bellin and I will be here live at 7 for Capital Week, when we'll chew over what happened under the Gold Dome last week, and what it means for all of us. Then I'll book my ticket right back here on Local Talk this coming Friday morning at 7, when I'll report on what's been making news around Iowa. I hope you'll be here, too. Have a great week.
Coming home to your tender sweet love, and you're my one and only woman. The world needs a bit of taste in my mouth, girl. You're the only one that I wanna be around. Wanna be.
That is Leon Bridges with Coming Home, and I so do appreciate Leon Bridges. And thank you, Dennis Hart, for the news. 4 months after Iowans voted in record numbers, Governor Kim Reynolds has signed legislation cutting the state's early voting period and closing the polls an hour earlier on Election Day. And once again, like last Monday, I'm quoting the Des Moines Register on this. The Iowa legislature approved the new laws and sent them to Reynolds' desk late last March, in early March. Every Republican present for debate in the House and Senate voted for the legislation, and every Democrat voted against it. Reynolds signed the law Tuesday. Iowa is among a national wave of Republican-led states whose leaders have expressed concern about the integrity of the 2020 elections, taking the lead from former President Donald Trump, who falsely claimed the election was stolen from him. While there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in Iowa or nationally, Republicans have described the state's legislation as an election integrity measure and said it will bring uniformity across Iowa's 99 counties. Democrats say the law will suppress votes and does nothing to improve election security. I've been looking at how the new laws will affect various groups of voters for the last few weeks in different ways. And in exploring this, I would say if people can be grouped together, voters that are disabled get less attention than they probably should, especially since any one of them could easily be ourselves. Nobody is exempt from disability or the potential of it. So Jan Driesman is a resident of Ames, and she agreed to record an interview with me about issues often being experienced by disabled people who want to vote. So here's what Jan had to say.
Do you need me closer? I can come closer with the wheelchair.
Yeah, that'd be great. Jan, please introduce yourself. Tell us what your disability is and what your daily life is like.
My name is Jan Driesman. I was born with cervical spina bifida, a birth defect that damages the spinal cord from neck on down. So I'm in a wheelchair pretty much all the time, and that has been for the last 2-3 years. I was not isolated like many people with the diagnosis are.
So you're somebody who is living with a significant disability, but you're living independently. You're not in a care facility of any sort.
Yes. I have a degree in education, and I've worked for the past 21, 22 years with the community school district. I'm very adamant about continuing to live independently with people who come into my home a couple times a day.
Have you voted since you were voting age?
Not every single time. It really depends on accessibility, the proximity of where to vote. The stress of it can be overwhelming if you're not in an area where you can get to the building, and then it depends on the weather. To stand there for that length of time in line in November makes it emotionally, mentally challenging. I'm pretty sure there were a lot of people who didn't vote that were qualified to vote. Some people have anxiety of being around a large group of people, and then to make a decision knowing that other people are waiting, that causes even more anxiety.
Would you say that it's important to a lot of disabled people to be able to vote by mail?
Yes. The freedom of having it home to decide, I think, makes a big difference in not feeling rushed and feeling confident. Except that if you have a person who is homebound and can't leave their home, and then on top of that to know that mail-in voting probably won't get to where it needs to go officially, then that even blocks them even more. People will probably go, well, why am I even doing this? What was to be the purpose of it? I'm just one vote.
Say you were worried about the mail being reliable. Or say you missed, for some reason, the window of opportunity to mail in your ballot by the deadline. Would you have transportation to go to deliver your ballot?
No. And I'm in a wheelchair. Who has transportation accessible to the electric wheelchair?
Now, this new law that has just been passed in Iowa makes it illegal for you to give your ballot to somebody to bring to the county auditor's office unless that person is a family member or an official caretaker for you. Would you have any family members who
No.
would be able to deliver that?
No. I don't have family members here in town, and nobody's going to come to the different town to deliver my vote. Yeah.
Right. Do you have the kinds of caretakers that work for you that would be in a position to drive to the town next door where the auditor's office is to deliver the vote?
No. There's a listing of things that they can and can't do, and out-of-town transportation is not one of them. So it would have to be something that they would do on their own time and volunteer their time, and I would not feel comfortable asking them.
Do you want to vote in the next election?
I think it's very important too, yes.
Do you think that restrictions add to the unlikelihood that people will vote who are disabled?
You're eliminating a lot more people. And this is supposed to be a country of representing all people. When the colonial time wanted to break away from England, they set up the voting to deter having a king. They wanted the people to represent the country, except that they wanted to be the ones who decided who the people were to govern the country. So you had to be white men of 21 years of age that owned land. And this is a way of holding power. So if you have a way of controlling the voting, then you believe that you have a way of controlling the country. So if you can control who votes and how they vote, then you think you can control how the land is going to be operated. So instead of it being all encompassed, you make that pot smaller with the intent, I believe, of deciding who, again, is going to have a voice.
Is it important for disabled people to have a voice in government?
Oh, my God, yes. Yes. It gets to be sometimes the survival of the fittest in this country rather than survival of the community. Inclusive means everyone involved in the community taking care of all of the community with respect to the individual.
Do you think that disabled people are being taken care of in Iowa?
No. I don't even know where to begin. There's just so much there. It's so rooted in our way of thinking that it's like blinders. It's like, oh, I have to take care of them. I don't need to be taken care of. I need assistance. If an insurance company can say to me, you'll never be cured, and we're not obligated to maintain, that says a lot to me. Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, was asked to define civilization, and she defined it not by how their artifacts were discovered, but by recovered broken bones of the leg. Because if you have a broken leg, it meant that another person had to stay with you, provide for your healing, provide for your food, provide for your protection. She said that would be the first time that a population became a civilized, because it meant that people cared about the other. That's the definition of leaders. Leadership is there to provide for those they are in charge of. Inclusive means everyone involved in the community. So if my leaders of this land do not respect those that they are in charge of enough to provide support, why are they calling themselves leaders?
Thank you so much for going into it. I'm Ursula Rudenberg in Ames, Iowa for COVID, Race, and Democracy.
That was Jan Driesman, who is a resident of Ames. I've asked Laura Bellin to join us for a few minutes to add some information about what we just heard when speaking with Jan Driesman. Laura is co-host with Dennis Hart, KHOI's feature Capital Week, which is a weekly review on our station from the Des Moines Capitol Building. And we're so fortunate to have Laura serving as our Des Moines government correspondent. As you may know, Laura is the well-known and acclaimed for her authorship of the blog Bleeding Heartland. Laura, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for inviting me, Ursula.
So I just wanted you to stop in for a few minutes to kind of help unpack some of what Jan was saying. Can you explain again the law changing, or the law change that is affecting the delivery of ballot that I was talking about with Jan?
Yes, this is a big issue, and I think it's going to come up in court before the next election. So in the past, if you requested a ballot by mail and were mailed a ballot and completed your ballot, you could have anybody hand deliver that ballot back to your county auditor's office if you didn't trust the mail or if you had some other reason for wanting it hand delivered. So under the law, the only people who can hand deliver a ballot are the voter, someone in the voter's household, an immediate family member, or a caretaker, and the bill doesn't define caretaker, but elsewhere in Iowa code, it has a fairly narrow definition. And during the subcommittee hearings on this bill in the Iowa House and Senate, representatives of the disability community spoke with great concern about this. And when the bills were debated on the floor of the Iowa House and Senate, Democrats in both chambers offered amendments that would have allowed voters to designate one person to return the ballot, and Republicans voted those down. So the upshot, as Jan said, someone living independently without immediate family nearby would have a lot of trouble getting someone, if they didn't have transportation and weren't able to leave the home, they would have a lot of trouble finding someone legally allowed to hand deliver the ballot. So not your friend, not your neighbor, not someone you know from church, not the person who delivers your meals on wheels. So it's really quite limiting. And a lawsuit has already been filed to challenge the law, and by LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, and they are challenging this provision that limits the hand delivering of completed ballots. They're not challenging it specifically from a disability perspective. I wouldn't be surprised to see some plaintiffs from the disability community either join that lawsuit or file their own lawsuit, because it really is quite limiting in how someone can make sure their vote is counted.
So, Laura, tell us again, what was the rationale given for this?
There was no rationale given for this portion of the law. Generally speaking, the Republican floor managers in the Iowa House and Senate, they didn't claim that there was any fraud related to this practice or other practices in Iowa. They said that the bill was designed to increase confidence in elections, increase election integrity. Another excuse they gave was that it would reduce voter remorse or regret by limiting the amount of time people have to vote early. One of the floor managers claimed that it would shorten campaigns, which was really not supported by any evidence, because candidates start running radio and TV advertising and start knocking on doors months before the election. But there was never any specific rationale. I mean, the unstated rationale is that Democratic groups or Democratic aligned groups often have what they call ballot chase operations. So they have, for instance, the Polk County Democrats had a very detailed operation where if they saw that somebody had requested a mail ballot and not returned it, they would have someone call or text or knock on that door and offer to pick up the ballot. And I think they got hundreds, if not perhaps even more than 1,000 ballots returned to the Polk County Auditor that way. The Republican Party doesn't have as organized an operation for ballot chase. So I think this is what they were trying to prevent, to have. They didn't want political campaign staff or volunteers to just be able to call and offer to pick up somebody's ballot. But again, the Democrats offered amendments that would have said that a voter can designate one person, and those were rejected. So the bill is very unclear. I mean, who is a household member? Actually, one of the legal experts I asked about it noted that it doesn't exempt postal workers from this limit. I mean, I'm sure their intention wasn't to restrict postal workers from picking up somebody's ballot, but technically that's, if you read the law narrowly, you could say that postal workers aren't allowed to pick up somebody's ballot because they're not an immediate family member and they don't live in the household. So it is really constrained. Also, since the window of time to vote by mail has been shortened and ballots now have to arrive by election day as opposed to the previous law, where if they were postmarked before election day, it was okay if they arrived a few days later. I mean, that's also going to be difficult. So there are going to be a lot of anxious voters. And it's not only the disability community. It will also affect people in rural areas and other people whose mail delivery service takes longer. But the disability community is going to be particularly affected because it is going to be so much harder. I mean, I can get in my car and within 15 minutes, I can be at the Polk County Auditor's Office and drop my ballot in the box. And obviously, that's not going to be possible for Jan, who you just spoke with.
Yeah, as Jan said, she doesn't know of any vehicle that could accommodate her wheelchair and take her to the county auditor. One of the things that was interesting, I thought, with the interview was when asked about this, Jan kind of went right away to her anxiety about the post office and saying that she was worried that if she mailed in her ballot, it may or may not get there, that she really had concern about that and would want to deliver you know, the ballot herself or have it delivered somehow.
And many people feel that way. I mean, my brother in Arizona sent me something by priority mail more than a week ago that should have taken 2 days, and it's still not here. So I think it's legitimate that we know that there have been more mail delays in the last year and a half. And of course, we all hope that the Postal Service will be operating more smoothly by the time of the next election, but there's no guarantee of that. And again, voters will have less time to receive a ballot under the bill and less time to return the ballot because it now has to be at your auditor's office by 8 p.m. on election day. It can't be postmarked a few days earlier and arrive later.
As we saw a demonstration in the last election, the incumbent president can affect the efficiency of the post office as well.
Right. And it's something voters don't have any control over. I mean, when this was raised in the floor manager in the Iowa House, Bobby Kaufman, said, you know, I have confidence in Iowans and I know that people can adjust their behavior and that people are going to be able to make this work. But you can't control the Postal Service. And it really will affect people in rural areas even more than people in a city. If I'm living in the Des Moines area and I put my ballot in the mail, it's pretty likely that within a day or two, it'll get to the county auditor. But for many people in rural Iowa, their mail, even if they're mailing to the county auditor whose office might be 10 or 15 miles away, it actually will be routed through a sorting facility in another county, and then it will come back to their own county auditor. So that can add days to the process even before some of the extreme postal delays we've seen more recently. And that was an issue in an Iowa House race in Northeast Iowa in 2018, where there were 29 ballots, absentee ballots, that voters had put in the mail before the election but arrived after the election. And it was because they were voters in Winnesheek County, which is where Decorah is, but the mail had gone all the way to Waterloo to be sorted and then back to the Winnesheek County auditor. And that added days to the process. And those ballots ended up not being counted. Of course, under the new law, nothing that arrives after election day would be counted. So I empathize with Jan's concern. I mean, I hope that this part of the law can be amended. And or I hope that there's some way that they can next year pass a different bill that makes it clear that people in Jan's situation can designate someone to hand deliver the ballot, because it's really a concern that voters shouldn't have to have about whether their ballot can be delivered. If they're doing everything right and trying to get their vote in on time, they shouldn't have to worry about whether things outside their control, like the Postal Service, will disenfranchise them.
Laura, when we spoke last night, you mentioned also actually another group of people. There's probably various types of people who will be affected by this. You mentioned the situation where somebody is in a domestic violence situation.
Yes, the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, they testified against the bill in the Iowa House and Senate subcommittees. And one of their concerns was addressed. They had a concern about the delays because a small number of people who are domestic violence survivors are part of a program where their mail takes longer. It's a way to shield their address from public view. But this specific provision they were also concerned about, and that didn't get changed, because the law says that somebody in your household can return your ballot, but if you live with an abusive or a controlling partner, that person might not want you to vote. You might not trust that person would safely deliver your ballot. You might not want that person to know that you cast a ballot. And so for people in an unsafe home situation, it's very important to be able to ask a trusted friend quietly to return your ballot to the county auditor. And that's something that won't be allowed under this law.
Yeah, and that's kind of subtle. And, you know, one would think, well, that doesn't happen very often. But actually, it does. It's actually.
Yes, and after the House subcommittee, Bobby Kaufman indicated that this was something that he would look at and possibly amend, but there was no amendment to that part of the bill before it was passed by the House and Senate. So I don't know what discussions were had behind the scenes, but several of the Democrats in the Iowa House were very upset that this wasn't changed. And the Democrat who served on the subcommittee, Mary Wolfe, even said that, you know, she had been led to believe that this was something that the bill's authors would take into consideration, and it wasn't. So this, again, this limitation to the bill is in the law is part of the lawsuit that the League of United Latin American Citizens has filed. That hasn't been heard yet in the district court. I'm sure eventually it will go to the Iowa Supreme Court, but we're not yet at that stage of the process.
But you think it's a part of the bill that actually has the potential to be changed again, that it's more likely?
I think so. I mean, compared to the other parts of the law that they're challenging, the limits to the early voting window, the shorter window to vote on election day and so on, those things are a little bit more there because they're not that far outside the national average. I think that the courts would let that go. But this limitation on who can hand deliver your ballot, I mean, you need to part of it depends on what standard the court uses to review it. Sometimes with voting restrictions, they subject those to heightened scrutiny. So the government would have to show a compelling state interest. But sometimes, especially with limits on absentee ballots, they say that the government just has to show a rational basis for the policy. LULAC is actually arguing that even under a rational basis standard, there's just no legitimate government interest in limiting who can hand deliver your ballot. And it's too burdensome on the right to vote. And they also claim that it's burdensome on the LULAC's right of free speech and free association because they won't be able to have their volunteers go around and help collect people's ballots. So we'll see how that goes and whether the courts do subject that provision to heightened scrutiny. But I think if there's any part of these new voting restrictions that are vulnerable to being struck down in court, it would be this issue because of the circumstances of voters like Jan Driesman.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for stopping in and talking to us about this. So it's just one more piece of the legislation that helps to understand what exactly is happening and what the consequences are. Thank you so much. And Laura, give your the address for your blog.
Thanks, Ursula. www.bleedingheartland.com online. And there's also a Bleeding Heartland Facebook page. And I am on Twitter at Laura R. Bellin.
Okay. And Laura and Dennis Hart will be here tonight at 7 o'clock to talk about the latest happenings in Des Moines with legislation and the government. And then that will be repeated again on Wednesday at noon. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back. And this is Local Talk. Welcome back. I'm your host for Mondays, Ursula Rudenberg, here with my engineer, or our engineer, Mike Murphy, and Anna Banana in the wings, soon to speak soon. And Anna, we're going to have you join in a little bit later on this conversation because you are also an expert on disabilities. But right now, Liz Zerker, the executive director of the Story County Community Foundation, has joined us. Liz normally comes on once a month to introduce you to a Story County charitable nonprofit organization, but today she's coming bearing information about getting money. She's coming to talk about grants. So, Liz, normally I give an introductory description of the Story County Community Foundation, but since today is more of a nuts and bolts discussion about the services that your organization offers, I'm going to ask you to spell out a little bit what the Story County Community Foundation is and the announcements you have at this time. And I think you have a guest you would like to introduce, too. So I'm going to toss it over to you, Liz.
Good morning, Ursula. Thanks for having us this morning. My guest today is Jennifer Dieter, and she is the vice chairperson on our advisory board of directors for the foundation. But she's also the chairperson of our grant making committee. And grant making is one of the really important facets of the Story County Community Foundation. And this time of the year, we start gearing up for our grant program. And those grants, two of the most important ones that we receive a lot of applications for, that process starts in June and goes until the end of September. So this is a great time for people to start thinking about their grants, their projects, their services that they're offering. So Jennifer and I just wanted to come on this morning and tell you a little bit more about our process and deadlines and where they people can get help if they need it.
So those of you who need money for your nonprofit, listen up.
Good job, Liz. Well done. So like Liz said, we have two types of grants that are probably the most prominent and most important, well-known throughout the community. One is our major grant. And as Liz said, our cycle is getting ready to open up. So it opens up June 1st. We ask agencies that are intending to apply to write a letter of intent. And that letter of intent is due on July 31st. And we get those letters of intent in, we review them, and then we invite a few of those agencies to come back and write a application for the major grant. And those applications are due September 30th. In 2020, we gave that grant, this grant is up to $25,000. And so it can be a very impactful grant for some of these projects, and especially in smaller communities around Ames that may not have the financial wherewithal. So it can be a very impactful grant for some of these communities. Last year, we gave it to the city of Roland. They wanted to enclose a park shelter, and they were able to do that. And this was a keystone of their fundraising efforts. And in 2019, that award went to the City of Zeering Fire Department. So we're trying to make sure that we hit all the communities around Ames and throughout Story County to help make those areas better places for everybody too. The second type of grant that we give that's really important is our community grants. And those applications are also due September 30th. In 2020, one of the big ones that we gave was to the Ames Public Library Friends Foundation. And this was super important because with all the online learning and everything, they were able to provide Wi-Fi hotspots to families that might not have access to Wi-Fi. So that was a great grant that was given, and it kind of showed our responsiveness to community needs. And so we really liked that one. We also gave one community grant to Mustard Seed Farm. They needed some help repairing their food and storage supply shed. So we helped give them money. We gave them money for that. It's a very competitive process. We usually get 40 to 50 grant applications every cycle. Usually for the major grant, we probably will get 10 to 12. So it kind of varies there. And we do invite the people that don't get the major grants to come back and apply for the community grant. It's all one application. They don't need to write two. If you need help, we do plan on having a grant information seminar to kind of give information about these deadlines and what you can do as you're writing your process or writing your grant. And I think that will be set the first week of June. Do we have a definitive date, Liz?
We don't yet, but I'll put that on our website and get that out to everybody when we do have a date for that and time. It'll be online, and we'll record it and put it on our website. So if you can't make it the date we have it, you'll have access to that information.
So Liz mentioned that our website, storycountyfoundation.org, and that's a great site. It's got all our grant guidelines on it, all the applications, all the reports that you need once the grant is finished. And you're sending in your report, all that information is there. And always our staff, Liz and Angela Harms, are both available to answer questions. You can reach out to me as well. Happy to help anybody. So
I have a tip for that. The KHOI has benefited a few times from the community grants, and we really appreciate it. We have a little plaque on our wall here in the studio. One of the things that's very useful is that doing the grant involves getting letters of partnership from other organizations that you've worked with. And this is really the most time-consuming part of writing the grant. So if you're thinking of applying, start now, approaching groups that you've worked with and ask them to send you letters, so that you're not having a lot of panicked phone calls at the last minute saying, where's that letter?
That's a great piece of advice. And most of the applications we do get come right at that deadline. So
I'm a grant writer by trade. And we, I think one thing that we are very good at is procrastinating. So yeah, letters of support are wonderful. You know, we ask that you be a 501c3 nonprofit organization to apply, but if you're not, you can partner with another 501c3 or a 170C1 agency, which is a public, a public school, a university, a library, or a city, those types of things, to apply and have those folks be your fiscal agent if you're not an official 501c3. So, we've tried to make the application process as simple and streamlined as possible. Awesome. So, I guess my best advice to folks is don't struggle if you're having problems with sections of your grant. Pick up the phone, give me a call, drop me an email. I'm happy to help in any way that I can.
Yeah, and feel free to think outside the box. I think one of the kind of beautiful characteristics of this grant process is that the Story County Community Foundation really is willing to fund all sorts of different types of projects. So If you are having doubts about whether you could qualify, call up and ask or just kind of trust that you can apply because it's amazing the diversity of different types of groups that you do fund. And it's always lots of fun to see who gets funded.
It is. It's very exciting just to know that we are able to partner with those agencies across the community and help to make Story County a better place for everyone to live. And again, with 2020 being the way it has, I expect that our grant cycle this year will be even more impactful than it has been in the past, helping some of these agencies kind of get back up on their feet if they need it. And that will be great.
Yeah. Liz, about how large is the pot of money that this is all coming from for the community grants?
Great question, Ursula. We just heard last week that we're going to be back to the pre-pandemic, funding, which, our funding comes from a portion of the gambling revenues. And so, we'll be back to that normal. We're hoping over $100,000, that range for our grants this year. Last year we had over $270,000 worth of requests, and wow, every single request was worthy of funding. Yeah. There was absolutely nothing wrong with any of them. So, Jennifer and I and the grant making committee and the whole board.
We lost Liz. She'll probably be Jennifer, you're going to have to finish that sentence for her.
Yeah, we really spend a lot of time reviewing those grants and looking through them and trying to find the best use. It's hard because we can't fund everything.
Yeah.
And we really, like Liz said, there are tons of worthy causes. Everybody deserves that money, but it's hard. We have a limited pot and we try and make the best decisions that we can.
So the large grant is about $25,000, so about $75,000 worth of smaller community grants, which usually
exactly
are around $6,000 or less, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So there's money, so there's funds. There's funds if you need it, apply. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. Well said. Thank you.
And K2I is grateful because I think we've three times been a recipient of those grants, and it's made a heck of a difference. And in fact, the audio console that we're using here to put you on the air was funded by Story County Community Foundation. So thank you, Liz and Jennifer. Any last words?
No, go to our website, storycountyfoundation.org. All of the new applications are online. So, get started.
So this is for nonprofit organizations. If you are a 501c3, if you're an incorporated 501c3, or if you're able to find a fiscal sponsor and, serve the community to make it a better county, right?
Correct.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Liz Zerker and Jennifer Dieter. Thank you for coming on and letting us know about that. And next month, you'll probably be back to tell us about another group that does get funding, just to show the diversity of who does get funding here.
We will. Thank you, Ursula. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thank you so much to Story County Community Foundation. And Anna Banana, you are kind of waiting in the wings, listening. And you also are an expert on disabilities. And I noticed that you had some thoughts on our conversation with Laura. You want to pick that up? And I see Laura still here, too. So, Laura, feel free to say something additional if you'd like. But, Anna, why don't you go ahead and talk about the Iowans with Disabilities in Action?
I just wanted to say this whole local talk show selfishly felt like it was designed for me. So I'm 501c3. I'm going to need to apply for the grant and get those support letters out. So thank you so much to the Story County Community Foundation. We are ABLE Up Iowa, formerly known as Iowa ABLE Foundation, which I listened to both the interview with Jan and Laura with fascination because, you know, 1 in 4 in the United States have a disability. So what does that mean in Iowa? In Iowa, according to the most recent data, there are 368,548 Iowans with disabilities. That's a huge block of potential voters. And so it matters because individuals with disabilities care about their school systems, where they work, they provide tax base. And so it matters to them. And I wanted to give a little plug for the Iowa DD Council because they have an initiative called the Iowans with Disabilities in Action, which is funded by the DD Council. It's a nonpartisan statewide initiative dedicated to generating greater civic and political participation among people with disabilities. And they do some really great work of mobilizing individuals with disabilities to have the information and the resources to be able to engage in what's happening in their communities on all levels. And so they have a conference once a year. They have programs. And so that website is the Iowa, I-O-W-A, ddcouncil.org. And so if you're an individual with a disability trying to figure out how to vote and to overcome barriers that prevent participation, that is a great resource. And Laura, I'm not sure if you know of the Iowa DD Council. I'm guessing you do. They do amazing work.
I've heard of them. I'm not as deeply familiar with their work, but definitely I've heard of the organization.
And again, you know, this is something that I think there's always a tendency to try and see this as a relatively small group of people who, you know, are not necessarily something, you know, we have to think about. But as you pointed out, Anna, this is a very, very large part of, and this is one of these so-called minority groups that we all potentially are part of. I mean, nobody is exempt from disability, and it is really a very large part of our community. And so thank you for that information and just helping to raise awareness about that. And thank you for the work that you do in that area.
Yeah, thank you both to you and Laura for putting forth this information. Because the other thing, as you were just saying, so that block, those are individuals who self-diagnose that they have a disability. But if you expand that definition of disability, where you think about what are the other barriers and obstacles that prevent people from, I think as I'm getting older, I realize that I have to wear glasses now. So that's a barrier to being able to see the ballot. So all of those obstacles, we think of ourselves as, and we talk about that this at our organization, that when people say disability, they just think about people in a wheelchair.
Right.
But that is so
possibly
much more.
All of us. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. My father just got a letter from the state saying that he's supposed to show up for jury duty in Des Moines. And my father's doctor just wrote a letter saying this man is 101 years old and he does not have the ability to be on the jury anymore. So if nothing else, all of us just get older, you know.
There was a change in the election law in 2017 that affected Iowans with disabilities. For many years, Iowans could vote a straight party ticket. You could just mark near the top of the ballot if you wanted to vote for all the Democrats or all the Republicans, and you could just fill in one box. And that was removed. So now people have to fill in every box. And a lot of people might say, well, so, you know, it's not that much trouble. But if you have a disability, if you have trouble gripping a pen, it could be burdensome to have to fill in every oval, because you can't just make a check mark or an X. You're really supposed to fill in that oval to make sure the machine, the optical scanning machine, reads the ballot correctly. So yeah. It can add a lot of time and inconvenience to someone with a disability, and that affects a lot of people with any number of conditions.
Yeah, as they say, the devil's in the details. Okay, Anna, you did have a heart-to-heart message prepared, so let's get on to it. We have a few minutes left, so let's do that before we end.
Okay, let's do it. All right, so this heart-to-heart message is from Tina B., and so her heart-to-heart is titled, Your Audience is on Your Side. So for all the KHOI listeners, they're on our side. And she writes the following. So how do you feel when you perform in front of an audience? Do you worry about all the thoughts flowing through their minds, their judgments, the one-upping? Are you simply freaking out for being in the spotlight? We worry about what others think. We like to be liked, accepted, so much that affects how we communicate with others. Negative thoughts can cripple you. These negative thoughts in our head result in how we feel about ourselves. That negative feeling then transfers to your audience. So what is the audience really thinking? The act of public speaking is a shared activity that involves interaction between speaker and the audience. Scholars say speakers do not give speeches to audiences. They jointly create meaning with audiences. Your audience can tell if you're conversing with them or at them. A few years ago, I witnessed a mind-boggling experience at a TEDx event. The speaker had a heavy topic, and her nerves took over. She stopped speaking. Her long pause became uncomfortable. The moderator came out and helped her recover her talk, handing her a note card. The speaker repeated the previous sentence and continued for another minute, then lost her place again. On the verge of tears, the speaker stood defeated, expressing frustration on her face. The moderator appeared again to assist. This happened one more time before she finished her speech. Then the most amazing thing happened. The audience erupted in applause. The speaker received a standing ovation for her presentation, the only one of the day. Now, what did this incident show me? The audience is rooting for you. They want you to do well. Instead of thinking, wow, she really stinks, get off that stage, the audience may have been thinking, wow, she's so brave, I wish I could do that. The speaker shared a challenging subject and became vulnerable. The audience responded, I see you, I hear you, I feel you. Being aware that the audience is more on your side and wishing you well can help with how you present your information. It's a game changer, really. By entering a speaking space with this in mind, it can help you present with poise, lessen the fear of being judged, of feeling small. As speakers force out these potential negative thoughts and push in the encouragement that your audience wants to learn from you and have a conversation with you, just don't go too long, but that's another subject for another time. So thank you, Tina B, for that lovely heart-to-heart message, and for the audience that's out there listening to us, thank you for not judging and being on our side for all the great information that we presented on Local Talk today. So Ursula, back to you. What do you think? Laura, what do you think of Tina B's heart to heart?
I think we need a standing ovation now.
Absolutely.
Well, you have been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Anna Banana and Laura Bellin. Thank you for listening. Also remember that you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org. And find some links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Tune in at 7 p.m. tonight for Capital Week with Dennis Hart and Laura Bellin for an in-depth look at this week's legislative actions, government agencies, the governor, and other events that affect Iowa government. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris. You also heard Leanne Bridges with Coming Home, and you heard my favorite, The Leaf Sheep. The Leaf Sheep. Okay, so thank you for listening. And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Anna, take us out with the last line.
Yeah, we'll see you again on the radio.